Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Constitutionalist number 14 with the Constitutionalist Republic Party.us out of here in Minnesota. I'm here with the other host. My name is Jeremy, by the way. I'm sure you all know who I am. I actually sit on the board, the executive board at large for the Constitutional Republic Party, and we have we got the head cheese in charge here on the phone with us. The other host of the Constitutionalist, Travis Bull Johnson, who sits as the current chair for the Constitutional Republic Party. So, Travis, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
Oh, I'm not doing too bad, man. Not doing too bad. Just like any other time, just trying to get stuff done and trying not to watch the news too much because it's too damn depressing.
Lately, it's really depressing. I've been keeping an eye on the Speaker of the House, and that's not looking good. It sounds like that Jim Jordan's not going to get those votes, and if he doesn't get those votes, it automatically goes to Hakeem Jeffries.
No, he doesn't.
That's what I was told.
No,
but we got 12 rhinos in there that want to vote on that side.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of where I was going to go with when we get to our little discussion section that's usually a little bit later of by the Republicans basically going with somebody like Jim Jordan, who the Democrats will never support and the moderates would have a hard time supporting. They're basically going to hand the chamber over to either to a moderate or a left-leaning Republican. Because they're basically going to make it where the Democrats are going to pick somebody that they can live with, and you're going to get those 7 or 8 Republicans who will go with them, who won't vote for a Democrat, but who will vote for a extremely moderate or left-leaning Republican that the Democrats can live with.
Right. Hence the word rhino, Republican in name only. You know, you get that from time to time. But we'll get into that discussion a little bit later on. Let's go through what we're going to talk about. Well, first of all, I want to apologize to our audience because last week when I went to set up the show on Tuesday morning, the site was down. It wouldn't let me set my show up. And so I waited and I waited and I waited, checked in like once an hour. And then finally I was able to set the show up midday, I suppose. And I got stopped probably 15 minutes before the show is when I could call in and get the switchboard up. And when I went to call in, and it said it was dialing, but it never connected. And Bull had the same problems when he tried to call in. So I just chalked that up to their site was having technical difficulties. I don't know what was going on, but we were unable, obviously, to have that show. But here we are. And let's just kick this baby off. So tonight we're going to talk about the 14th Amendment. And this is what the 14th Amendment says. It says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws. Now, it also states that representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for president and vice president of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive and judicial officers of the state, or the members of legislative thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such state being 21 years of age and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens, 21 years of age in such state. Now, there's more to that, but I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. We've kind of want to have a discussion on, you know, the first part of the 14th Amendment and when the 14th Amendment became the 14th Amendment. And me
well,
and Bo were just talking.
You know, Jeremy, I think you really need to go into Section 3 because that's going to be a hot topic tonight.
Oh, let me see if I can find it. You got it in front of you, Bo, or no?
I'll go ahead and read that one.
Okay, go ahead.
Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or any other state who having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or a member of any state legislator or executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may by a vote of two-thirds of each house remove such a disability. Section 4 goes into the validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for the payments of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any other state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States or any claim for the loss of emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. And then the last section is Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. Now, of course, I wanted to touch on Section 3 because that has been in the news quite a bit lately. You have numerous lawsuits pending in various states trying to prohibit former President Trump from being on the ballot. Because then they're citing that section of the 14th Amendment. So that's a lot to talk about tonight.
Go ahead.
All right. I'll keep going then, I guess. When we talk about Section 1, and it starts with, again, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are subject to and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state in which they reside. This is not the first time this is mentioned in the Constitution. It actually goes into birthright citizenship a little earlier in the Constitution as well. But this, again, highlights it and basically removes any sections or any doubts that this is for all people and not just white males, basically, is what it was taken to be before this. What's very important on this and what I like to point out to people is, again, it specifies if you were born in this country and you're subject to the laws of this country, you are a U.S. citizen. I highlight that because we have presidents who have come and said, you know what, we're going to change the law so that doesn't happen anymore. Well, guess what? You can't. Why? Because the Constitution flat out here states what the that the United States has birthright citizenship. There is nothing in a president or anybody else who is campaigning on changing that could do to change that unless they're going to amend the Constitution. So if they're up here promising that, hey, you know what, we're going to change this, we're going to get rid of this law where people who are in the United States illegally and have kids here, we're going to change it so those kids are not citizens. No, they can't do that. When they're saying that, they're either ignorant of the Constitution or they're saying they don't care what the Constitution says. Because the Constitution is pretty – what's that?
I'd go with the latter, that they just don't care what the Constitution says.
I would, too. So, but that's pretty plain. And let's keep in mind, this did come about right after the Civil War. So this was basically to verify that the former slaves were U.S. citizens. Now, they also put in there the little section about under the control of the United States or subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Why is that in there? Basically, that is in there because of diplomats. That is specifically in there so that children of diplomats are excluded from this because diplomats are not subject to jurisdiction of the United States. They have diplomatic immunity, as does their families. So basically, these people are not subject to a lot of our laws, so therefore they are not, even if they have family who are born here, they are not considered U.S. citizens.
There's a lot of court cases too involving many different aspects of the 14th Amendment, like many, many court cases.
There's so many little nooks and crannies of the 14th. I mean,
yes.
Last few weeks we've had cases where we've had trouble talking for an hour on an amendment. We could probably talk for all night on the 14th and probably still not get everything covered.
No, not even possible.
The 14th is very important because, again, there's so many court decisions that that rely on the 14th. It is probably the one amendment that has made the biggest impact on this country over all of the other amendments. The reason I say that is because it is the 14th Amendment that basically stated that all states had to abide by the Bill of Rights. Prior to the 14th Amendment, the states had basically the ultimate authority to talk about what happens within their borders. But that second half of the first section basically stipulates that without due process of law, they cannot deny any person within this jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So therefore, they had to have the same protection in states, within the states, that they have under the federal government. And that 14th has been used numerous times, basically, to show why the states were also bound by the Bill of Rights. Because, again, originally, they were not. The original Constitution, Bill of Rights, were only meant to limit the federal government. They were not; it was not intended to limit the states. But the 14th changed that.
There's a lot of segregation issues and due process issues in the 14th Amendment, a lot of court cases involving that where they use the 14th Amendment to fight against their or fight for their case or against their case. And, some of them have lost, states versus for one city wanted to segregate a park. They didn't want to let colored people use the park. And that didn't fly. The courts overturned that, and they said, no, you're definitely you're going to let them use the park. It was a hot topic back in the mid-1800s. Yeah. That's before the whole civil rights movement. But the civil rights movement, I mean, there's a lot of the 14th Amendment, the civil rights and or the – how am I supposed to say that? There is a lot of references to the 14th Amendment through the Civil Rights Movement and, the Constitution in general. But the 14th Amendment is a really, like, if you ever get a chance just to sit back and sit down and look at it and study a little bit, you're going to see how important the 14th Amendment was to our country. It's very important.
Well, yep. And I do want to point out one other little tidbit about the 14th Amendment. Again, this was soon after the Civil War. Until a Southern state ratified the 14th Amendment, they were not allowed to have representatives in Congress. So in order, the Southern states had to agree with this amendment before they would be allowed to participate in government again after the Civil War. that is probably one of the reasons why it was able to get passed and ratified within the 2 years that it was, is because, again, all of these southern states, if they wanted to have a say in their government, at that point had to ratify and agree to it.
And it also reserves the right to remove people, states' representation from Congress, if they are found to violate that constitutionally.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's very important to remember that also, that because this it's very valid today. So they got to walk a fine
yep.
line if they want to have their representation in Congress. So, yeah, it's a very interesting amendment. Let's put it that way.
Again, if you look at Section 5, the Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. This is the only article that I know of, or the only amendment that I know of, that specifies that Congress has that authority to enforce this article of the Constitution. Because if you remember, just about every other article or every other right, it's up to the courts to enforce. But this is basically giving the legislators the power to be able to create new laws with the 14th in mind. And trust me, and Congress has used it. Congress has used it to give more and more power to the federal government under the guise of the 14th Amendment. If you look at things like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is a very good, very needed, great law, but again, the 14th Amendment is what they used to be able to justify that. Because if you remember, if you look at the actual Constitution itself, not including the amendments, the federal government was pretty much hands-off when it came to elections. It was all up to the states, and the states were to decide how they were going to run their elections, how they were going to appropriate things. But again, the 14th Amendment is what they use now to get involved in elections. Even today, if you look at the news, there are various southern states right now who are being sued. And basically, the courts are throwing out their districting because they're saying it violates the 14th Amendment. So, because, of course, states are able to draw their districts however they want to draw them. But if they're drawing them in such a way that it does not give proportional representation, then the federal government is coming back, and the courts are coming back and saying, no, you can't do that. This district is not legal. And then they're taking that power away from the state legislation and giving it to federal courts to redraw or decide on these boundaries. Why can they do that? Because of the 14th Amendment stipulates that the federal government can make laws to enforce this amendment. And people are wondering what I'm talking about by the districts and proportional. Say you have a state let's make the math simpler. Let's just say four state representatives. 45% of your state is black and 55% is white. The majority of the people who are black are basically located in one consolidated area of the state. Basically, if the legislator goes in there and they kind of picks it apart where they take that one consolidated area of black people and they divide it up into the four other areas, basically. So there's never a black majority in any of the other four districts. Basically, that's what they're saying came back and said you can't do. Because even though that state would be 45% black, well, guess what? They don't have a majority in any of those four districts. Chances are they may never get a black representative from that state, although 40, 5% of the state was black because of the way they drew those districts. That is the kind of gerrymandering of the districts that the courts have come back and said you can't do, and they have basically stated because of the 14th Amendment.
So can we use an example of, like, Ilhan Omar in Minnesota?
Right.
She is elected representative in a predominant, or not a predominant, but a very high population of Somali immigrants.
Right. Yep.
So that is one of the examples of being in, and I don't know if you can compare that to gerrymandering, but, I mean, there's examples in Minnesota about gerrymandering. Well, that's all over the country. But
it is, but it's the opposite of the example I just used.
Right.
Where the example I just used is they split everybody out so they don't have a majority in any one district. The other way they gerrymander is putting as many of that minority into one district as possible. So
like they did
it limits their ability to win another district. They're willing to forfeit that one district as long as they limit the damage, I guess you could say. As long as they can limit the impact in the other districts.
Yeah. But that's how we get to where we're at. You know, if I'm using Ilhan Omar as an example again, if Ilhan Omar was in a bigger district, do you think she would ever have a chance of being elected?
I think she would. And this is why is in that, especially in the Somali community, is they're very structured, I guess you could say. And otherwise, if they're told to show up to vote, they show up to vote.
Right.
And let's face it, the majority of the other, especially the whites, they're not that structured. If they don't, they may show up, they may not. It's how excited they are. Whereas, and you notice this with a lot of immigrants as a whole, they've come from countries where they weren't allowed to have a say. They weren't allowed to vote. So now that they are allowed, they really look at it and say, think it is part of my civic duty. And they show up to vote because, again, this is something they were not allowed to do before. And I mean, that's human nature. When you're not allowed to do something, and then all of a sudden you are allowed to do it, you're more likely to do it. Just because, again, you realize what it's like to not be able to.
So what – I'm trying to think off the top of my head here. What would be a good example of what you were talking about, 45% and 55%? I'm trying to think of a state that has a higher population.
It's either Alabama or South Carolina is going through something with that right now.
Okay.
Of similar things, and not as far as gerrymandering and trying to limit another majority black district.
That's the 14th Amendment. I was reading through it a little bit here, and there are so many court cases involving
yep.
segregation, involving due process. Some of the others? Here it is. The five main points of the 14th Amendment. I came across that. But the five main points are state action, privileges and immunities, citizenship, due process, and equal protection. So when you hear people talk about, you know, the media likes to push that whole racist agenda, or when somebody disagrees with you, oh, you're a racist. If you remind them that the 14th Amendment exists for that very fact, that protects people, that protects their rights, that protects them. And it go to the current situation with the southern border. When people immigrate to the United States, we were just talking about this too. Now, if they have a baby here in the United States, and that baby is born here in the United States, that baby is granted citizenship.
Yep.
Based off the 14th Amendment. And that's what we were talking about. There's some of these politicians out there that say, well, no, we shouldn't do that. We can't do that. That's not right. Well, the 14th Amendment guarantees that. I get that the reason they did that was because of slavery back in the Civil War era. And, you know, a lot of slaves were born, you know, here in the United States. So they were granted immediate citizenship.
Well, it actually goes back a lot further back than that. The Civil War and the 14th Amendment was based to ensure it was covered by all races. But it goes back to medieval England is where birthright citizenship was first practiced. Is if you were born in a kingdom, you were a subject of that kingdom. Regardless of who your parents were or where they were from, if you were born you're in a kingdom, you were a subject of that kingdom. Because so much of our Constitution was, again, based off of English common law. That's where birthright citizenship originated. Now, yes, it became a bigger issue with the 14th Amendment solely because at that point, not every race was recognized as having as being an equal citizen, and the 14th was meant to fix that. And that's when they basically reemphasized that yes, if you're born here, regardless, you are a citizen.
And that's there's a lot of controversy with that. You know, there's a lot of people that jump right on that bandwagon with their, you know, a representative that they may agree with or, you know, follow along with. And they're like, yeah, you know, that mob mentality. But if you really truly believe in the Constitution, you have to respect and honor the 14th Amendment. But here's the thing. If you disagree with that, which that you can disagree with it all you want. It's still in the Constitution as an amendment, 14th Amendment. But that's probably why it's so important to have border security and a path to immigration rather than just opening up the borders and just letting them flood the gates, because they have babies here, and that baby's granted immediate citizenship. So,
yep.
And I'm not nothing against immigration. I'm pointing out the obvious here that if you want to curb that just a little bit and just control it in some sense, that is why it's so important to have border security. So
yep.
I just wanted to throw that out there. Two thoughts.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, no nation can exist without being able to maintain their borders. But yeah, but that's exactly right. Is the fact that what gets difficult with that is if a child is born here and they get birthright citizenship, we cannot deport a citizen. So we can't deport that child. Now we also can't kick out the parents and leave that child here because there's nobody to take care of it. That's where things start getting dicey. That's where we start getting the what they call anchor babies. Because, of course, once that baby is born, well, now that family has an anchor here. Because you can't just kick the parents out without somebody to take care of the baby. And you can't involuntarily deport a U.S. citizen. So what do you do? That is where things get so dicey. And that's why it's such a hot, debated issue. Because, again, everybody, okay, including me and everybody else, when we find a way around a law, that we don't feel is just or right, we're going to capitalize on it. We're going to utilize it. And that's what basically started to happen here is because our laws are so hard, our immigration laws are so difficult, basically people have found a way to work around it with anchor babies. And it's not an easy fix because, again, that is anchored in the 14th Amendment. And then, I mean, and you're going to have some hard asses around who are going to say, you know what, I don't care, deport the parents anyway. It's not our problem. They decide to have the kid. It's not our fault. What kind of a human being are you if you start preaching that and actually believing that we should take the parents out and leave a child here without a family?
Yeah, that alone, Bull, is horrible to even think about. Technically, yes, you could probably deport the parents. However, what kind of human being would do that? I mean, then goes into the system.
Yeah, and if you pay attention, you're going to hear people say that, though. People actually saying it'll send a message. It'll send a message to others. But, I mean,
yeah,
is, just because something is legal doesn't mean it's right or doesn't mean it's moral. And just because
Correct.
Something is right and moral does not necessarily mean it's legal.
Right.
And that's where we run into a lot of issues. Because we're filled with stuff like that.
The immigration issue itself is a hot-button topic. It has been for many years. We could go back many years, and I don't want to get too far into it, but yeah, there's a lot of personal opinions and feelings, but there's also a lot of constitutionally protected rights that people are willing to overlook because of their personal opinions and feelings, and whether they agree or disagree with how they got here or immigration in general. So that's why it's so important to elect representatives that are willing to sit down and have that tough discussion and talk about what do we do to curb this problem, to solve this problem without being completely immoral about it. I mean, I couldn't send two parents back and leave their kid here and put them in our system. Our system is a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's why, I mean, when I was running for Congress, I mean, whenever the talk of immigration would come up, I'd be the first one to say, yes, we need to secure it, we need to seal our border, but we also need to make it easier for people to immigrate legally. I mean, we used to preach for like an Ellis Island type immigration where people would come in and you do a background check on them, and if there was nothing really mean or disqualifying on them, they would be allowed to come in. And I tell you what, I mean, and I still fight with people on this to this day who are just like, oh, there's too many other people coming into the country. With the labor shortage we have right now, there is no reason we should be having the issues we are with immigration. They need to loosen up the strings somewhere, because I talk to people, contractors and stuff like that every day who can't find workers to work manual labor.
Fast food. I can tell you about my experiences out here on the road. It's tough out here. If the truck stops, they can't get reliable, decent help. Nobody wants to work.
Nope. I mean, it's just and you know what though? I mean, that's, and you know, this is frustrating for me to talk about, because this is. A conversation was heard a while back by a member of my household, and there was a guy who was trying to hire a couple kids to help pick up hay bales. And the mother of those kids went absolutely apeshit about how her kids were too good for that. They weren't going to be doing manual labor. That's what's causing these issues, is because you have this self-righteous thought process of, we're too good for that. And this was nothing more than picking up hay bales for a farmer. But this mom just went absolutely eat shit over it because her kids, her boys, are too good for to do any kind of manual labor. And I wish I could say it was an uncommon thought, but it's not. I mean, I grew up in the era where they started with that mentality of, you better go to college, otherwise you're gonna get a job with your name on your shirt. Well, guess what? Those guys with their names on their shirts right now, the electricians, the mechanics, they're making damn good money. I guarantee you, they got all the work they can handle. They're living damn good lives. Most of them do not have student debt. Looking back at it now, that was some pretty shitty advice. But it's that entitlement, and now I'm going to get off on my tangent like I usually end up doing. And it's one of those things that I have an issue with, okay, because this country, when it was founded, did we decide on a king? No. We wanted elected representation. We didn't believe that the person who is basically the leader of a country or whatever should be that just because of the status of their birth, because they were born to noble or royal blood. We didn't believe in that. That's not what this country is based off of. But to hear the Americans, meant for Americans, people who are born here and raised here, and that's that whole different mind. So basically you're saying because you were lucky enough to be born here, you're better than everybody else. And you should get more benefits. You should get more of everything else because you were lucky enough to be born here. When did we lose that whole mentality of the character of the person is what matters, not where and how they were born? But that's what we've gotten back into. And that's just frustrating for me, because this whole country was built on a rejection about the situation of your birth making a difference on the worth of the person. And that's where we've lost, again, another avenue where I think we've lost our way, is because there's this whole mentality, if you were born in America, then you're better than you are because of your birth. You're better than everybody else. And no, you're just luckier than a majority of the world. Just because where you were born doesn't make you better. It means you started off with a good roll of the dice. But what you do with it from that point to make the difference, not the fact that you were born there. It should not give you that forever leg up and protect you from challenges because you happen to be lucky enough to be born here. If you want that job, that good-paying job over that immigrant, then you need to make sure that you are better than they are at that job. Not count on the fact that you were born here and they weren't, to protect your job. And I think that's why, if you look over the last 30 or 40 years ago or 50 years ago, we were pretty much number one in the world for everything. And at that time, we weren't having this big fight about immigration. We were considered a melting pot. We let people in, and people were having to continue to improve to get better jobs and to move up the corporate chains or move up to better paying jobs. They were having to just continue to compete. You had to get better as you got older to get these better jobs and these better opportunities. But then they started saying, wait, let's just eliminate the competition. Let's start limiting who gets in so we can protect these jobs, make sure we keep them So instead, we got away from getting better. Wasn't that old saying, iron strengthens iron, steel strengthens steel? Well, we've gotten away from that. We have stopped allowing ourselves to be challenged to get better. And that's everything across the country. I mean, everybody nowadays prefers the safe route rather than to take any risks. But it's only by risk that we improve. It's only by taking those chances. And if we don't allow ourselves to be in a situation to take those chances, well, that's why we're no longer the number one country in numerous categories anymore. That's just my two cents for what it's worth.
And listen, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to join this conversation, we do have a guest call-in number. So if you are listening live on this broadcast, you're welcome to call in. And that phone number is 516-387-1733. And when you get through and you're hearing us over your phone, just press that number one. And that'll give me the cue on the switchboard that you want to come live on air and talk about what we're talking about, or maybe have a whole separate question off topic. That's fine. You can do that. Again, that phone number is 516-387-1733. And again, make sure you press that number one. You know, there's a couple things I wanted to move on to tonight, and I know Bull did too. I have to ask you one question, Bull, before we completely go off on a different subjects here. But did you hear about the resolution that the squad and members of the squad and some other people put forth in order to stop Israel from responding to Hamas's attack in Palestine? Did you hear about that? And what were your thoughts on that, if you have heard about that?
I did not. I mean, I've heard something about a resolution, but I haven't really went into to it very much. I was, unfortunately, on the road doing a lot of stuff today. But before we go to that, I want to touch one more thing on the 14th Amendment before we transition. And it's the one section of the 14th that we have not talked about yet, and which I feel is probably actually one of the more important sections of the 14th Amendment, and really all of our all of the amendments, and that's Section 4. And I'll go into why I think this is important. I'm gonna read it again real quick. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for the payment of pensions and bounties for servers and suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay for any debt or obligation incurred in the aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. I want to highlight the first part of that. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services, suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. So, with that part of the amendment in mind, is the debt ceiling legal? Is it constitutional? Because, again, Congress has already created this debt. They have issued public debt authorized by law when they passed the resolutions or the bills. So can they come back now and say, we're not going to allow the United States government to pay these debts? Would not that in itself be a violation of the 14th Amendment?
Good question.
I mean, that's kind of been one of my little pet peeves when they start talking about the debt ceiling. And you know what? I'm as physically conservative as they come. But when Congress passes a law saying we're going to pay this, that is now a valid debt of the United States, And it can't be questioned. You can't say, well, no, I'm not going to pay it now. You have to pay it. Any action not to pay it is a flat-out violation of the 14th Amendment because you're basically saying, we are not going to pay that debt. We're not going to say that debt is valid. We're going to refuse to pay it. And that is one of the things, I guess, I was different with a lot of when I was running for Congress, and I was there was some friction with a lot of conservatives who are friends and supporters of mine based off of this because they didn't necessarily agree with it because they're like, hey, we got to stop paying this. We got to stop spending this money. It's like, well, I completely agree. We do have to stop spending this money, but you can't decide to say, you know what, I can't afford to pay my credit cards anymore because I need to save that money for something else after I've already spent the money on the credit cards. You've already agreed to pay that debt. And there is no bankruptcy protection for a country. So you can't just pull that rope. That's where I have a issue with a lot of the Republicans and members of Congress who keep on fighting over the debt ceiling. Is because you know your debt ceiling is you've already violated the debt ceiling when you passed appropriations that was going to bring us past that number. You've already done that. So I believe that when that debt ceiling is reached, it should be a case where we don't pay our debts, but they should be forbidden from any authorizations of new money. Period. Israel gets bombed. Sorry, we're at our debt ceiling. We can't spend anymore unless we pass a law to change that. Ukraine getting bombed. Sorry, guys, that's new spending. We can't spend anything on that. This country's going through a famine. Sorry, we don't have any money because we've reached our debt ceiling. We cannot appropriate any new money. We just finished building an aircraft carrier. We need to build another one. Sorry, we can't do that because we've hit our spending limit. That would be new spending. That's what I would like to see because, again, that to me is a lot more in line with the 14th Amendment, the Constitution, and the whole power of Congress to pass a budget. And it would force them to do it. But yeah, I wanted to throw that out there a little bit before we switch gears, because to me that's a very important part of the 14th Amendment, and it's one that does not get talked about as much because people look at it and their immediate thought is just the fact that, you know what, it basically meant that no state could pay back the Confederacy's debt. That's basically what a lot of that amendment was for. Was to prohibit and send a message to the rest of the world going, hey, you financially back something, a Republican against us, you're shit out of luck for your money because you ain't getting it back. Now, can you tell me a little bit about that resolution that you mentioned?
I just asked if you'd heard about it. I haven't gotten time to dig into it. All I know is that it was a resolution to prevent Israel from responding to the attacks from Hamas onto Palestine. And all I know is by the squad and some other members of Congress jumped on board with it. I'm trying to figure out is why are we so divided on this Israel-Palestine thing when now I get there's innocent people in Gaza, the Palestinians, but what about the innocent people in Israel? And I'm looking at the big, like the huge picture here, small picture. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm tired.
You know what? At the same time, what about the innocent people in Ukraine? I mean, you have the Republicans here. I'm calling out the Republicans. who are screaming about spending any money in Ukraine, basically saying it's not our fight, which I agree with, but these are the same people right now screaming that they need to elect a speaker because they need to give money to Israel. Why?
I don't agree with giving money to Israel or Ukraine,
yeah.
This is just my opinion.
Yeah, well, and that's part of my whole thing here is we do not have a mutual defense agreement with Israel. That we have no treaty obligations to go there. They have 2,000 American troops on alert right now to deploy to Israel. Why?
Don't we have two carriers too?
Yeah, and here's and yes, Israel was the victim of a terrorist attack. But I want to point something out here, and I've been called anti-Semite a few times over the last few weeks for pointing some of this stuff out. But we give about $3 billion plus every year to Israel for their defense. That's a B. $3 billion a year. And they are by far our biggest foreign aid that goes out over any other country. Maybe not now, right now, because of the war in Ukraine. They're probably surpassed them. And people keep on claiming Israel is our best ally in the Middle East. Well, I've got a news flash for people. There is only the top three countries responsible for spying against the United States is China, followed by Russia, followed by Israel. But yet, this is one of our biggest allies in the Middle East. Israel.
Let's not forget that Israel's the size of New Jersey, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep. Israel has never sent one soldier to support any battle or any war that the United States has been in, including the Iran, the Persian Gulf War, or any of that. Now, you have countries like Jordan who have sent their soldiers to fight next to the Americans. And this is a decision that was not necessarily in Jordan's best interest at home, because there was a lot of people who did not think Jordan should be supporting or helping the United States. But Jordan said, we are your ally. You need us. You need some help here locally. We'll do it. Yet Israel is considered a better ally and friend than Jordan is. And I understand some people's argument of, well, Israel is the only true democracy in the Middle East. Well, just because the country is a democracy, that doesn't mean they're our best friend. Israel probably has the biggest lobby in Washington, D.C., even bigger than probably any other corporation or industry. The Israeli lobby is huge. So when people are here basically talking about how they're our best ally, I just don't see it. I don't see the facts to back it up. And people will, especially conservatives, especially Republicans, they will at that point when I start saying, why should we be defending them? Why should we be responsible? You know what they do? They open up their Bibles. Because the Bible says no. Let me stop you right there. That the Bible has no relation on our foreign policy, and it should not. But when they can't find any other excuse on why we should be there, that's what they do. I mean, and again, people really need to learn their history. They need to learn, especially like Hamas. Hamas was originally a form of the Islamic Brotherhood.
Started in 73 by Israel, funded by Israel.
Yep. That's where I was going. Because they were looking for a counterweight against Yasser Arafat and the PLO. And Yasser Arafat was more of a secular ruler. He wasn't the ultra-religious. He just wanted the Palestinians to live their own and run their own lives. But Israel said, hey, if we can get them fighting each other, then one, they won't be fighting us. And two, we're going to kind of be able to do what we want because they're all going to be focused on their internal squabbles. So Israel basically started funding that what grew into today's Hamas, which is, again, I'm not blaming Israel for this attack that they just suffered, but Israel does have to take some responsibility, I think, to the situation that's on the ground. They have had basically the West Bank and Gaza on some sort of lockdown for the last 20 or 30 years. So you have a lot of young Palestinians there who have been desperate. When you have young people who are desperate, who are having trouble, how am I going to feed myself? All of a sudden that organization, those extremists who are willing to help you get food and who will talk about how bad and nasty the people are that's causing you all this hardship, it makes recruiting these kids a lot easier. When you already don't have anything else to lose, how hard is it to convince them to commit suicide with a suicide bombing? I mean, we see Americans commit suicide every day. Why? Because they feel they are desperate. They don't see any other way out. These foreign countries are the same. These other countries are the same way. Just like we have to take some responsibility for 9/11, because if you actually look through 9/11, the problems that we've or the hostilities that we've generated within the Middle East, a lot of it has been because of U.S. meddling in Middle Eastern affairs. Whether it's because we were trying to do something for oil, or we were trying to help the Shah of Iran, or what? It's because we wanted to control other countries in the Middle East. We got involved, and we spent money on one side or the other. And whenever you do that, it creates enemies on the other side. And a lot of that came to roost because we kept on sticking our nose where it honestly didn't belong. And we continue to do so because, again, instead of taking care of what's best for us at home, we want to put our fingers on the scales across the world, and we can't do that. But, again, it comes up to that situation, though, of at what point if you criticize something the Israeli government has done, does that make you an anti-Semite? When you start calling for accountability or responsibility or you try to take a look at something from a outside perspective that is not the narrative being pushed by one group or another. So, I mean, it's just – but as far as your resolution – basically, what you're talking about, they're calling for a resolution for urging an immediate ceasefire. And that's where, I mean, people are complaining about, like, wait a minute, you want a ceasefire now or after they got hit? Would you have listened to if somebody had told us we need a ceasefire right after 9/11 got hit, would we have listened? No.
And furthermore, what about the ceasefire in Ukraine? Why aren't you asking Ukraine to have a ceasefire? They're losing Ukrainians in massive, massive numbers. Like, they're not winning that war.
Yep.
There is no winning that war for Ukraine.
Well, you know what, though? and I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there. They may not be winning, but I don't think they're losing right now either. And so I think it's they're not losing any more ground, and I mean they are still picking up a little. They're losing people, but again, at what time, what point does America or United States get to tell another country that they have to give up land for peace? At
well,
what point does America tell another country that, well, this other country invaded you and took 20% of your land? You need to let them have it so you can have peace. Would we accept that? Say Russia came and invaded the Western United States. Well, let me rephrase that because most of us wouldn't give a damn if they took California. Let's say Mexico invaded and took Texas, took three or four southern states. Blitzkrieg, we weren't aware. We were our soldiers are all over the world. They weren't there to defend. Mexico takes physical possession of the southwestern United States. Would we come back and listen to people who said, well, so many people are dying on both sides right now. Let them have it. Don't try to take it back. Don't try to regain your territory. Don't try to regain the resources that are the oil fields in Texas. Just let them have it so people stop dying. Would we listen?
No,
would the United States agree to that? So why do we expect Ukraine?
My point was, they're so quick to jump on and say, you know, have a resolution for Israel to not retaliate. But the hypocrisy part of it is, where were you with Ukraine? Why should Israel stop?
Yeah.
Then why shouldn't Ukraine stop?
Exactly.
That was my point.
Yeah.
I was trying to make.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
whether
no,
I agree with it or not. You know,
I wasn't focusing it towards you. It's just the overall mentality that we've been hearing.
Right, right. It's just it's you can have it one way, but you can't have it the other way with these politicians. It's like if we're going to be straight and forward across the board, let's be straight and forward across the board. Let's not pick and choose. You know who can do what and who can't do what. Well, who the hell are you? You know, are we some kind of totalitarian dictatorship where you can tell that country they can do what they can do, but not the other country? No, you can't do that because we don't agree with it. Well, dude, come on, that doesn't work.
Exactly, and you know what? If the two countries battling came to us and asked for help, that would be one thing. But I mean, unfortunately, and we did the same thing. So it's hard for us to it's hard for me to sit here and finger pointed Israel about how many innocents are getting killed with their retaliation, because let's face it, I mean, how many innocents were killed in Iraq with our retaliation?
Right.
I mean, we're not exactly in the position to judge anybody else on that with our own history. But the question is anybody, did we learn from it? But again, if we try to tell Israel, you know what, let this go for now. There's too many people dying. I mean, they're just going to look at us and go, get behind me, Satan. Y'all are the number one country in the world who has done that recently, other than Russia currently. And you're going to sit here and tell us we can't respond after we've just went through this massive attack and lost all of these Israeli citizens and all these babies that were killed, and you're going to tell us that we can't get justice? I mean, I just don't see it. I just don't see us being in a position to do that, but at the same time, I don't see us in a position that we should be continuing to fund them for it either, because then the blood is on our hands as well.
Right. Well, we were windy tonight.
Yep.
That's okay. we had a lot to talk about. I honestly don't think we've even hit or, like, touched the tip of the iceberg on the 14th Amendment, really. There's a lot to talk about a lot of ins and outs.
Well, there is, because, I mean, we didn't even talk about one of the most controversial points that we mentioned earlier, and that's whether Donald Trump can be kept off the ballot by the 14th Amendment.
I don't know. Maybe that's something we have to – maybe we can do a continuation on. I know I have these episodes set up for 3 hours, ladies and gentlemen, but I try to keep them around right around that hour mark. There's multiple reasons, but I want to explain it to you. The number one reason is because people's attention span today, they don't go for 3 hours. So we lose you after an hour and a half, or even a half hour. It's like, okay, I got other things to do. I don't have 3 hours to sit here. So we try to keep it around that hour. Number two, both Bull and I, we're both busy, busier than hell, and we're just trying to get through our daily lives too, while still, you know, talking about the Constitution and keeping it fresh in your memories. So those are the two major reasons, and I've had a real long day today, and Bull has been busier than hell the last month and a half. We both have, really, but we're not. I'm not opposed to do a continuation of the 14th Amendment next week. Are you, Bull?
No, not at all. I was about to suggest that. Let's go ahead and schedule next week as being part two, where we actually discuss the ramifications of the sections a little bit more, where we could talk about the limitation on the possibility of whether Donald Trump can be kept off the ballot on it or not, and if so, what would the requirements be, and talk about some of these other issues that we just kind of barely touched on today.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and I wanted to add one more thing. The reason we keep it at an hour, I've been doing Blog Talk radio shows for over 2 years now, and I've got hundreds of episodes. Over 100 episodes I've done. Some were at 3 hours, some were at two, but I have found that a good majority of our listenership comes from keeping it right around that 1 hour mark. So people don't, you know, it's hard to dedicate 3 hours of your life to a radio show, you know. So even though you can go back and listen to over 3 hours, you know, or the 3 hour, if we recorded the 3 hours, you could go back and listen to it in three parts, but we can always have a continuation next week of this conversation, and that gives us a little time to refresh. And so why don't we plan on doing that, part two of the 14th Amendment next week, involving states that want to keep Trump off the ballot, and Bull said, what are the ramifications of that? What could that cause? I believe it would cause a lot of damage to this country, but we can discuss that next week. So if there's anything you'd like to would you like to use a closing statement before we jump off here, Bull, and we'll touch base next Tuesday?
I'd like to just thank everybody for tuning in tonight, and I encourage people, hey, call in, help us. Y'all been listening to me talk for quite a bit. Let's hear what y'all have to say. Let me know if I'm on an island all by myself on this, or if you agree or disagree.
Yeah, and I'll say that number one more time. It's 516. Write this down, please, and save it in your phone. And you'll always have it. Just put radio show in your phone. It's 516-387-1733. And then when you get through and you're hearing us over your phone, just press the number one that lets us know you have something to say. That's the easiest way. It's going to be the same phone number every single week. Every Tuesday at 6, unless, of course, there's technical difficulties like there was last week. But if you call that number and you don't hear us on, then you know that something happened, something, you know, fell apart. But we'll be on next Tuesday. We try to, me and Bull had a discussion about it. Like, we want to be more consistent to make sure that we're on air come hell or high water. I know that life gets to both of us and all of you sometimes. So, we do appreciate you guys listening to the show. Our numbers are coming up. I paid close attention to that so we can make adjustments and you know, see maybe there's something different we need to try. And that's why we kind of start talking about stuff that's going on in the world after we discuss, you know, whatever amendment we're discussing in the Constitution. So we do appreciate you guys listening, and hopefully we get more of your participation through phone calls, and we have a chat feature also. So you're welcome to come on there, and if you don't want to get on air, ask your question over the chat, and I'll be sure to ask Bull or answer your question myself. Anything else from you, Bull?
No, and we're good on my aspect. Just thank you for having me as always, and we didn't even get to talk about the speaker race.
Oh, that's right. Well, I guarantee you there's going to be more news coming out of that in the next couple of days, so stay tuned for that, too. Just pay close attention to how that goes down, ladies and gentlemen, because that's going to be an interesting conversation. I think we can probably incorporate next week with the discussion we're going to have on part two. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to end this episode of the Constitutionalist number 14, and we're going to call it part one because we're going to have a part two next week. Again, it'll be Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Central Time, and we hope to see you there. And please give us a call in or interact through the chat feature. I hope you all have a great week. God bless each and every one of you, and we'll see you next Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Central Time for the Constitutionalist. Have a great week.